slide your pack.
You'll see.
Vous avez lu l'histoire de Jesse James? Comment il vécu? Comment il est mort? Ça vous a plu, hein? Vous en demandez encore? Bien. Écoutez l'histoire de Bonnie and Clyde. Alors voilà, Clyde a une petite amie. Elle est belle et son prénom c'est
Bonnie.
À eux deux, ils forment le gang Barrow. Leur nom
Bonnie Parker
et Clyde Barrow.
Bonnie and Clyde.
Linoleum knife.
I was feeling a little Serge Gainsbourg-y today. What the heck? My name's Alonzo Duralde. I am the film critic for The Wrap / Reuters and What the Flick on YouTube. And Dave White of Movies.com is not with us this week. He is in Dallas visiting his mom. And so I am thrilled beyond words to have a very special guest with us today. She is the film critic for People Magazine, a newly minted member of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, and all-around cool dude. Please welcome Ms. Alinda Wheat.
Thank you so much for having me, Alonzo.
Oh, it's our pleasure. We're so glad you could be here.
Thank you.
Alinda is one of the people, we talk a lot about going to press screenings and who we see there, and, you know, there are certain people that we avoid at press screenings. We're not really sure what they do or why they're there, but we've just sort of learned over time that they're loud talkers or they're annoying or they're just weird in one way or another that's not in the good way. And Alinda is one of the people that you want sitting next to you because she always has something very wry to share.
I'm also the person who's always gesticulating wildly during the movie, so I'm at least fun to sit next to.
Yeah, no, well, it's almost like an audience indicator of like how excited we should be about something, you know, so how much are Alinda's hands flying about. So now, how long have you been at People?
2 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I know, it's flown by. I can't believe it. And it's my first, well, technically, it's my second real job as a bona fide minted movie critic, and I couldn't be happier.
What was your first?
My first was many years ago, back in graduate school. I'd say it's early 1999.
Mm-hmm.
I was at UC Berkeley, getting one of those masters in journalism that we all so desperately need. And so
useful and helpful in the real
world. So useful and helpful in the real world. Actually, it was extremely helpful to me. I should say that.
Okay.
If you already know how to write or know people in this business or have a clue how to get into it, maybe you don't so much need it. Me, I was none of those things.
So it was your entree.
It was my entree. Gotcha. And this was back in those really innocent, halcyon days when you could walk into a brand new Oakland Weekly newspaper and say, hey, I really like movies. And they said, hey, let's talk about that. And I think I might have had like an hour-long conversation with these lovely women who were the editors and walked out with a job.
Nice.
Yes, that never happens anymore.
Well played. Now, and then I know for a long time you were at Entertainment Weekly writing the very hilarious What to Watch column.
Well, thank you, sir. I was.
You were one of my favorites. I would always look for your name, in fact, before I even knew who you were. So what was the segue from Oakland to EW?
Oakland to EW was, I was desperately trying to get from Oakland directly to EW, but as many careers in journalism go, mine was a winding serpentine path.
They can be circuitous. Yes.
They can be. And that path had to first go through Fortune magazine.
Oh, wow, okay.
Right. I was not aware of how one applies to an internship at a place like EW, so I went through the timing program, which said, hey, Fortune wants her. And I rightly, I think, panicked.
Sure.
Picked up a few courses in business journalism, went to New York, and thus began my career. I loved Fortune, actually. We stayed there for about 3 years.
Wow.
Then went to Entertainment Weekly when my mentor at Fortune became the boss at EW.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, it was really, really fortuitous. It was divine intervention of the most divine. And I was there at EW for about 7 years.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, covering television mostly, but also obviously still nursing a deep love for film. Glad to be back in it.
Excellent, excellent. So you're very much ensconced in the Time Warner family at this point.
Deeply. In fact, I'm a Time Warner baby. If I were to be thrust out into the world, I'm not entirely sure what I would do with myself.
I hear you. It's funny, you talk about going to Fortune. Yeah, I would be like, are you watching The Newsroom?
I'm not, but I've been told I should be.
Because there's the producer character played by Emily Mortimer has to, like, be part of some panel discussion about the economy and knows nothing about the economy. And so she's getting Olivia Munn, who has this, like, PhD, to sort of explain the entire U.S. economy to her in 2 days. And that'd be the kind of crash course I would have to take.
Best of luck with that. Yeah, I spent my entire 3 years at Fortune pretty much faking it until I made it. And I'm never quite sure if I made it. But I can still talk to you about annual reports and stock prices if you want.
Now, are you a native West Coast gal?
I am not, although I did grow up here. Mm-hmm. I'm originally from Kansas City, Missouri.
Get out.
I am. I'm a Midwestern girl, which is why I dress like a Midwestern tourist today.
You are such a Cornhusker.
I try. and a brief stint in Hawaii. My mom had a job in Hawaii, and I went with her for a year.
Nice.
Came back, and then...
Is it nice, or is it, like, nice to visit, but if you live there, it's just...
No, it is nice, and I think as an adult, I would love it, but when you're seven, you know, from Kansas City, and all of your family, which, and I have a huge family, it is a long, long plane ride away. That's tough.
Gotcha.
But came back here for, I think, fourth grade.
Okay.
And then left for college.
Wow. All right, so for all intents and purposes, you're a Californian.
I like to say I'm a Midwestern Californian with a nice little stint in New York.
Well, look at you, Miss Well-Traveled.
I try.
I lived in the same house until I graduated from high school, so, you know, I kind of envy those. You know, I don't know, it's weird. I think people who travel a lot when they're kids are better at certain social adaptability, you know? Like, I was never the new guy. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I started in pre-kindergarten with everybody else and then, like, stayed in the same school literally until I graduated from high school. So I was never the new guy.
Well, new girlism was never my problem. It was weird girl.
Oh.
So you know, when you're weird girl, new girl is irrelevant.
New, they get over. Weird stays.
Quickly.
Right, gotcha. Well, so as you were pointing out, Dave picked a doozy of a week not to be here.
Yes. Only for his mother will I forgive him for this.
Hey, I had to pay to see Total Recall just for this program, so we're all making sacrifices.
I paid for 360. I think we're even.
Okay, all right, yeah, fair enough. Well, let's dig into Total Recall, because that's the biggie this week, the big new movie. A remake, sort of the 1990 Arnold Schwarzenegger, Paul Verhoeven movie, both based on the Philip K. Dick story, I Can Remember It For You Wholesale. Neither of which is particularly, I've never read the story, but I'm assuming that neither is super true to the original source material.
I think that's safe to say.
Yeah. So what did you think of this new one?
I was bummed. Bummed. Well, because the first one is fun. It's silly.
Sure.
It does not take itself seriously in the slightest, and that's what it has going for it. This one is a much darker, dystopian, sad kind of thing about a man who doesn't remember who he is, and it's really kind of ticked off about that. Even though he never stops to really have a moment
to
talk to anyone about it.
When I was watching it, I was thinking, this would be a really good direct-to-DV, like, sort of cheesy sci-fi thriller. But as a movie called Total Recall, you know, it's kind of a letdown because, I mean, yeah, the first movie doesn't take the material very seriously, but this one... is both not fun and not taking the material
particularly
seriously.
Which is, you know, a cardinal offense for anything released between the Memorial Day and Labor Day.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's either like, either throw it out the window and make something else, or if you're going to do it, like, do it
have some
sprightly.
Fun with it. Lighten
you know,
it up.
Yeah,
you know, show us more women with three breasts. Do something crazy.
Exactly. Yeah, there's not nearly enough sort of, and there's no Mars in this one. Like it's a very sort of it's a recognizable future. In a
right.
way,
Let's back it up a little bit and tell people where we are.
Oh right. Okay. So we're on Earth, most of which has been devastated by chemical warfare. So basically, there are two inhabitable places left. There's the United Federation of Britain. And then there's the colony, which is Australia. And all the, like, working class schnooks live in the colony and take this big elevator up and back every day called the Fall.
Okay, but...
That goes through the center of the Earth.
There we go!
Not since the core.
the center of the earth. Do you have to be smarter than a fifth grader to know why that's a problem?
Yeah, they just sort of conveniently leave out a lot of things about the rotation of the core and, oh, just whatever. It's basically, it is as rooted in science as the Ice Age movies.
Basically.
Yeah. So Colin Farrell is our lead, and he has this drudge job he lives in the colony. He works in the UFB on an assembly line making RoboCops. And it has all these nightmares where he's, you know, being chased, and he and this woman are fighting off, you know,
being apprehended.
More RoboCops, exactly. And so he goes to Recall, which is this place where they basically implant memories in your head so you think you've had a vacation or you've, you know, been a rock star or whatever. They, you know, they give you false memories.
But it is the opiate of the masses to keep these people...
Exactly.
You
know, yeah.
And
they live basically in Blade Runner. Like,
right.
It's always raining in the colony, and everybody's all mashed together. So there's all these like Asian languages stacked up on top of each other, and Cyrillic, and all the signs are in 80 languages, and
just like the apartments are all stacked up on top of each other. Although for a place where apparently space is at a massive premium, he has a really nice apartment.
He does. There is. I was noticing that was like a pretty rude. Like, I would say a lot of New Yorkers would be jealous of his slum apartment. You know,
I never had it so good in Manhattan.
I'm sure. Yeah. So he's living there with his wife, played by Kate Beckinsale, who this film confirms is the worst actress alive today. I mean, working in movies, she's terrible. And, like, what the hell happened to Kate Beckinsale? Because you go back and you look at, like, Cold Comfort Farm.
Right. One of my favorites.
Yeah. Hilarious movie. She's so funny and she's charming and there's so much promise there. And now she is, like...
And now she is Len Wiseman's wife.
And now she's Len Wiseman's wife, yes. Len Wiseman directed. He's the guy responsible for the Underworld movies and the fourth Die Hard and...
And Total Recall,
yeah. And so she, of course, you know, it's a spoiler. You know, she's in the Sharon Stone role. So you basically, you know, she's actually the sort of evil person who's assigned to keep an eye on Colin Farrell while he doesn't remember what's going on. And she operates in two modes, which is basically like fake understanding and...
She's always the girl coming through the door with the gun.
Yeah. You know, with her dead-eyed stare, but her dead-eyed stare is actually dead-eyed.
It's truly dead-eyed. Nothing there.
Yeah, it's you know, Tyra season one. It's like, don't give me dead-eye.
Right.
You know, there's nothing happening.
There's no smizing happening.
No smizing at all. And then, of course, the only thing that makes her look any remotely competent as an actress is that the other female lead is Jessica Biel.
Well,
it was also a wet paper bag, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of expressing any kind of emotion or character or anything. There's a lot of shooting and chasing, and some of the chasing is pretty good, I have to say. Like when she's chasing him through the grimy apartment blocks and stuff, there's some cool jumping and gadding about in that.
Sure, that's entirely borrowed from the Bourne trilogy.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, like I said, this is a dynamite straight to DVD
movie.
You know, and it flirts with some ideas that I guess are in the original in terms of the idea of identity and who are we really and what do we remember really and that kind of thing. And they cannot, like, backpedal from those scenes fast enough. Like, they just give you a dollop and then, whoop, it's back to the races.
Right.
And it gets kind of numbing by the last third.
If you mean numbing meaning boring, then
it's really repetitive, and you don't feel much of a stake in it. The ticking clock is kind of wobbly in terms of what is it that he's trying to prevent and why are they doing it in the first place? Why is the head of the government who is about to do this horrible thing on the other side of the planet going to the other side of the planet to be there when it happens?
This is not a horrible, nefarious plot that he can conduct from somewhere else.
Exactly. Like, Dick Cheney did not go to Iraq, you know.
Exactly. Well, and the plot itself is so ham-fisted and stupid, and I mean, it just...
Yeah. It's a mess. It's a mess, this thing. If it were more fun, you would forgive it, but it really does take itself so seriously. It's so gray and sloggy, and, you know, there's some cool... Like, if you look at Total Recall now, I'm sure its idea of future tech is kind of ridiculous in terms of, you know, phones and computers and virtual tennis and whatnot. This movie actually kind of nails some things that seem not that far-fetched. Like, they would, you know, the kind of thing where keyboards appear in midair.
Right.
And people have, you know, phones embedded in their hands and stuff.
Oh, and the coolest part, that if you touch that hand to a piece
of glass, whoop, you get a screen. Yeah.
Beautiful display screen of the person talking to you, you know.
Yeah, I want one.
I want that. I'd have a phone implanted in my hand for that.
Totally, yeah, yeah. Just stand in somebody's car and lean on it, you know.
Well, the look of it is actually very cool. They, like I said, they borrowed from the right places in terms of that set design. It's just, and it kills you, because I, for one, adore Colin Farrell.
Yes, absolutely. And it's gotten to where, you know, I think, okay, you do this movie, keep your career in that place so that you can then go make a Neil Jordan movie for 10 cents, you know? Because, yeah, like, did you see Ondine?
I actually really enjoyed Ondine.
Loved Ondine.
He was lovely in Ondine.
And, you know,
he's,
in Bruges.
He's lovely in The Way Back. He's,
yes, yes.
He actually made that Fright Night remake for me.
Sure, yeah.
I don't mean he made it for me. I'm sure he did it for himself. But, you know, it worked for me. How about that? But, you know, he's a lovely, lovely actor who has never had the career he deserves.
No.
And this is not the way to get it.
No, definitely not. I mean, I think that he at least has figured out that he kind of has a bifurcated career.
Yes.
Like, he has the sort of junky leading man stuff that he'll get cast for, that he can make money on, that the movies will make money, that will, you know, allow him to have cachet as a film, you know, as a name, basically. But that really the good work is being done with the small European directors, you know, on little tiny indie films. And so, you know, if we have to endure the occasional Total Recall to get an Ondine, fine. You know,
right.
Whatever. I understand that's how the business works. But at least he's figured out that part out. He's not just doing these movies.
No, he is the human embodiment of One for Me, One for Them.
Totally.
And Total Recall is One for Them.
Yeah, he's the guy Julianne Moore.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said.
So, meh on that one. Also opening this weekend was Celeste and Jesse Forever, which is a movie that I originally saw at Sundance, and it didn't change very much. Starring and co-written by Rashida Jones, and co-starring Andy Samberg, and they play a longtime couple who are technically separated, but he's basically living in the studio behind the house, and they still drive each other everywhere and hang out every day and, like, you know, indulge in their sort of private jokes and little, you know, secret language that couples develop, and everybody around them's like, you guys have got to stop this.
They're a perfect couple who happen to be divorcing.
Right, right. And so, you know, the elephant in the room is the conversation that they do not want to have about, like, well, we really need to get that divorce thing happening, and we're going to be seeing other people now, and all that sort of stuff. And my thing with it is, I think the two of them, and did they ever actually date or not? I don't know that I want to know. But
I don't think that they did.
Okay.
But.
Well, what they bring together, this really amazing chemistry, I think. I think as a couple, they kind of relate to each other and talk to each other in a way that you don't see in a lot of screen couples. And they really, and not just that they click, but just the way that they kind of, you believe they have this long shared history between them. And so then when the movie inevitably has to be about them not being together, it's kind of a drag because you sort of miss them as a unit, you know.
Well, and that's one of the I think the minuses of the film is that I personally, you know, I basically am Celeste. You know, I'm one of those driven, more corporate types. My husband is an artist. I did not understand why these people were divorcing. You know, it seemed to me like they could have made it work if they tried just a little bit. I don't know. It just, they didn't sell the divorce well enough to me, so I never understood the impetus for why we had to be separated.
I mean, I guess I sort of took it on faith because they told me, but you're right. They don't really, like, draw you a map of how all that stuff happens. But unfortunately, once they do separate and they have to start kind of figuring out stuff on their own, it turns into yet another movie about someone in their early 30s discovering that they're now an adult, and what is that going to be about? And I'm getting tired of that movie. And I want, you know, Judd Apatow does it really well, but even he is sort of like, that well is running a little dry.
Right.
If you're going to do it, it's got to be really fresh and special. Like, you know, Dave and I will talk about it when he gets back. We saw Todd Solondz's Dark Horse, which is a movie that I have issues with, but I think it's at least so thoroughly unsentimental a portrait of what a real 40-year-old virgin looks like,
right,
that it at least it takes it to a new place. This just sort of felt like, you know, and it, you know, the whole, all the sort of Celeste wacky dating mishaps, you know, just kind of felt...
Although she does date Chris Messina.
That's true.
Who is my current crush.
That's a plus. He's everywhere.
He's everywhere. I mean, you can see this guy in Ruby Sparks. You can see him...
He's on Newsroom.
On the Newsroom, which is one of the reasons I ought to be watching it.
Totally.
He's truly everywhere. I mean, he's been around forever, but yes. It seems like he's really breaking through now.
No, definitely. Funny guy. Although Dave always calls him not Mark Ruffalo.
Dave is mean.
Yes, but I like him a lot. I like him a lot in Away We Go, especially. But anyway, so I don't know. It goes from it starts out in a place that feels really different and unique, and just winds up being familiar. I like the ending; like they kind of bring it back to something at the end. But there's a chunk there in the second half that just feels like
Part of the disappointment is that again, this is co-written by Rashida Jones.
Right, right.
You know, we've been looking for. I love rom-coms. Unapologetically, I love rom-coms. I hate it when they do the exact same thing over and over again. Sure. And she does that to Celeste. She turns this smart, ambitious, creative, funny woman into a complete shrew
right. Who
then has the messy, boozy meltdown. I mean, right. She spends... she's the maid of honor at her best friend's wedding, and the best friend is Ari Grainer. And they have this sort of pre-wedding barbecue they're all having. It's great time, right? Mm. Except that Rashida Jones is spending the entire party drunk off her tuchus, you know, with a smear of ranch dressing on her face.
Right.
That no one does with the kindness of wiping off.
You know, to the point where she finally passes out on like
a floaty
in the pool.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's just like, yeah, I know. You want better. I don't know that this is... I don't know how excited I am about Rashida Jones as a writer after this film, but I am excited about the idea of Rashida Jones and Andy Samberg as a screen couple. Like, I think they really have a certain zing that you don't get a lot that's really kind of lightning in a bottle, and I hope they go somewhere with that.
I don't know if it's quite Andrew Garfield, Emma Stone zing, but I feel you. I think that they do have something there, and I love that we saw something deeper from Samberg that I didn't realize was within him.
Yeah, this is probably the most dramatic that he's been asked to go up until now, and he's okay. You know, it's not one of those... I didn't think it was revelatory, like, wow, this guy can act, but he doesn't mess it up.
Right.
You know, he's perfectly fine, and I'm sure he will continue to grow as he has more experience on the big screen and stuff, but...
Alonso, it's August. Not messing it up is really all you
need
to
guess,
do.
Yeah, I know. Why am I being so demanding? Oh, God, you mentioned... 360, so I guess we'll touch on that.
Well, I assume that's what our musical interlude was referring to.
Oh, no, I just, it was a song I like. They don't always connect, necessarily. Why don't you explain what 360 is?
Oh, no. Well, it's one of those, you know, very international jet set kind of everyone is connected to everyone else kinds of narratives that doesn't really gel, but is supposed to be saying something deeper. And I think the deeper message is YOLO. twice in this film they say you only live once, and if your movie is based on a bad tattoo meme, then something has gone wrong. It's from director, and I'm going to pronounce this terribly, Fernando Meirelles.
That sounds close enough.
Who did The Constant Gardener and City of God, so this is, you know, not schlub.
Well, Dave and I are not City of God fans.
You're not City of God.
No, and I hated Blindness.
Okay.
I had forgotten about Constant Gardener. That was a decent movie, but oh, did you see Blindness?
I didn't see Blindness, but he is capable of making a decent film.
So pretentious. So, it's the kind of movie that gets, it was the opening night movie at Cannes.
Okay.
Which is always a stink burger, you know, mm-hmm. But it's always a well-intentioned one, and oh God, yeah, Blindness is just...
Well, I mean, he carries his pretension through in 360.
No kidding. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, carry on.
It's got an international cast. Some of the names I'll read for you that you will know are Jude Law, Rachel Weisz, Anthony Hopkins, Ben Foster, and Lucia Sipasova, who's an actress who kind of starts us off. She's an Eastern European woman who decides that the only way to really make money is to be a prostitute.
Right.
And thus... we're off with the races, but this prostitute who has an encounter with Jude Law, and it sort of tumbles forward from there.
Well, you know, it's the umpteenth takeoff on that play La Ronde,
right.
Which has turned into a movie, which also begins and ends with a prostitute. So, you know, I think that was part of the sort of cultural borrowing going on there was that she's the kickoff, and she's actually one of the more interesting characters in the movie.
She is.
I was sad to see her go, you know, when we went on our merry trail of.
Well, you know, and there are so few of them. I mean, Anthony Hopkins does a lot with his character. He's a father who's lost his daughter. She's missing, presumed dead, but he's on his way to identify yet another body that may or may not be her. And he's given some nice scenes, nice round role there, but. You know, Jude Law and Rachel Weisz are just so paper thin.
Yeah, Dave and I were calling this, it's one of those Babble Crash movies.
Yes.
Yeah, where it's like, yes, it turns out everybody's connected somehow, and I don't know that it ever really has, and, you know, I guess if you're making a movie like Babel and it's about multiculturalism and the global society, then there's some point that maybe is being made about how we're all interconnected, you know, no matter what. But this movie just sort of feels like a gimmick. Like, it's just sort of cutesy when, oh, look, there's so-and-so and there's so-and-so and they're in the same room.
Well, I mean,
and
it's not even really about multiculturalism. I mean, yes, we're in various countries, but the brownest person we get is Brazilian.
Right.
So we're not really trying very hard.
Yeah, and it's more just kind of like, oh, isn't that cool? Oh, isn't that cool? But it's never cool. It's never that interesting. And it's written by Peter Morgan, who wrote The Queen and Frost Nixon, and again, capable of better. Just after a while, it kind of feels like, you know, there are two separate cases where women do something incredibly stupid and
enormously
dangerous.
Enormously stupid. See, okay, now you're getting to my big issue with this
just
movie.
To keep the plot going. It makes no sense whatsoever.
You're getting to my big issue, not just with this movie, with any movie.
Uh-huh.
The absolute worst thing you can make me do in watching a film is ask the question, who does that?
Exactly, yes.
You know, and there twice these women do things where you're like, oh, who does that? Who lets this person into their hotel room? Or who introduces their wife to their blackmailer? You know?
Or who gets into a car with a stranger to go to another location? I'm like, come on. Yeah, so just a lot of stupidness going on. And ultimately leading not anywhere very
to nowhere.
No, there's no grand point to any of this. It's just sort of like, you know, like one of my favorite sort of La Ronde ripoffs was this movie in the 90s called Chain of Desire. Not a great movie, but an interesting movie, and it was very close to La Ronde in terms of it was about people who were having sex with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as you go through the chain, you know. Sometimes it's man to woman, sometimes it's woman to woman, sometimes it's man to man. It kind of, you know, switches off. And given the time that it was made, it was really a movie about HIV.
Right.
And that's kind of the ending, where you sort of find out that the first person, you know, I think that's the ending of the movie. You find out the person that it all started with, you know, gets diagnosed.
Right. So it's Kenzie and everything connects.
Yeah. And so then you think, well, okay, well then what happened to all those other people, you know? And so, and so that made a point about the time that it was being made, you know, about the era in which it was set. And this movie,
I was hoping you'd know what the point was.
No.
So you could tell me.
No, a lot of puffery, basically. What else? Oh, the baby maker.
Now see, this is where I really decided I hated you.
Oh yeah, my apologies. Oh brother. Okay, so it's, you know, you gotta look closely at the credits, because I saw that it was directed by the guy that did Super Troopers, and I thought, oh, well, great, that movie's hilarious. I did not look closely at the screenwriting credits, however. One of them is a co-writer of Strange Wilderness, which is one of the very worst movies I've ever seen in my entire life, and both of them have written at least one Ice Age feature.
Right, Ice Age The Meltdown.
Yes, thank you.
You know, don't slack on their credits.
No, it's very important to know which one, because they're all so different.
Exactly.
Anyway, so it is the umpteenth movie about uptight straight people who can't get pregnant and boo-hoo-hoo. And it's Paul Schneider and Olivia Munn, who I like very much in other things, but who have no chemistry at all. Like
these people act like they've never met, much less are married.
Totally. Like we were talking about, you know, how great Sandberg and Jones were. These two, like the first scene in the movie, they're having dinner to celebrate their third anniversary, and it literally feels like this improv exercise between two people who've just met, and who've not only just met, but like maybe had a fender scrape in the parking lot and don't like each other very much. There's just no snap to that at all. And they're trying to get pregnant, and it's not happening, and then they figure out that it's his fault, and he doesn't think that can be the case because back in the day, he made the money for her engagement ring by going to a sperm bank, so now it's about going to the sperm bank and having to steal his last sample to knock her up with, and...
you know, this is one of those movies where I start getting nervous, because I'm sitting in the darkened theater, silent as the grave, and a couple of people around me, mostly dudes, I have to say, start giggling, and I that's when I always have this panic moment of, oh my god, it's happened, I've lost my sense of humor, I no longer know what's funny, no, and then I realize, no, they're all delusional. This is the least funny film I've seen this year, and okay, it's less funny than The Watch.
Ouch.
There you go.
Yow. Well, I don't know. I mean, do you think it's less funny than That's My Boy?
See, here's the nice thing about working for People Magazine. Oh, you get to pick what you see? When we know that something is going to be absolutely terrible, I can choose to avoid it. Especially when they don't screen it for critics.
I want to go to there.
It's a great thing.
Lucky you. Oh, they screened it for critics. So, anyway. It's pretty miserable, yeah. And well, actually, it reminded me of another comedy I hated this year, which was Friends with Kids.
You hated Friends with Kids?
I hated Friends with Kids.
Okay, well, now I have to temper everything you say because you're a bad person.
Oh, oof. No, well, you may have to leave. Anyway, the thing about what it reminded me of Friends with Kids in that I'm looking at something that's supposed to be funny. There are funny people in it. There are funny people involved in the making of it. The premise has the potential to be, you know, laugh-inducing in the plot. And I'm just watching it and not laughing.
Right.
And that's the thing. You're watching it and, you know, there's all these great people in it. Nat Faxon, who is now an Oscar winner, you know, which kills me. The co-writer of The Descendants. But I always remember him from his Groundling stuff. Did you ever see this thing? I'm going to go off topic on this for a second. Did you ever see a show they do here called Beverly Winwood Presents the Actors Showcase?
I have not.
Oh, if they ever do it again, you have to go. It's basically, the premise is that everybody in the audience is a casting agent or, is looking for talent, basically. And you're seeing...
Which in Los Angeles is actually true.
Exactly. And so you're seeing people from this acting school who are doing their scenes in the hopes of getting signed. And the people doing the scenes are all improv people who are playing bad actors doing scenes from recognizable stuff. So, like, you'll get, like, I remember seeing Cheryl Hines as this sort of dippy housewife and this African-American guy who said his name was Juicy doing a scene from The Diary of Anne Frank. You know, or like, Dick Van Patten and Liza Minnelli doing a scene from The Crucible, you know. And Nat Faxon would do this character where, sort of like kind of cut off t-shirt, sort of, you know, dumb dude guy. And he and who's the guy that he wrote, his writing partner who's on Community? Do you know who I'm talking about? The other guy who won the Oscar for The Descendants.
Mr. Angelina Jolie Lake.
Exactly, him, yes. I'm blanking on his name.
His name I'm blanking on
And people
well.
Are now yelling it at the speaker. Anyway, the two of them did a scene from Jeffrey where the other guy clearly was gay and Nat Faxon clearly wasn't and was uncomfortable doing the scene. So, like, they would never touch. Like, he sort of spent most of the scene kind of running from the guy. And instead of saying HIV, he would say, I'm HIV positive. God, he was so funny in that. The killer on that one was always the last sketch they would do. They would set it up that it was a scene from The Glass Menagerie, and the woman playing the girl Laurie was a newcomer, but the gentleman caller had played the role, you know, at the Williamstown and all these sort of, you know, reputable theater, blah blah blah. The lights come up, the girl's about to deliver her first line, and she runs off stage and gets sick. And then the announcer says, the role of Laurie will now be played by so-and-so's mother, Fern Magnan. And out comes Jennifer Coolidge with, like, this huge, like, high-stacked pink blonde wig, this sort of, like, kind of Beverly Hills matron skirt suit, but with a very inappropriately short skirt, and, like, gloves and big chunky jewelry, and she just, like, does her smile thing, and tries to, like, kneel down next to the glass menagerie, but it's hard to get on the floor because the skirt's so short. And she starts, and her voice is like, you know, it's my glass menagerie. I got a pig giving a bunny a shampoo. And then when the gentleman caller dumps her, she, I can't begin to impersonate it on a clean podcast, but she unleashes this stream of invective. It's hysterically funny. All of which to say, all of that is very much funnier than anything that happens in the Baby
Makers. I just laughed probably twice as much as I did in the Baby Makers.
Yeah, you know, it's, yeah, I don't even know how to describe this movie. It's, you know, it's supposed to be a caper farce. It's supposed to be a relationship comedy.
With no relationship and a caper that's a farce before they even get into it. And, of course, the caper is being sort of orchestrated by Ron John.
Right, the who may or may not have been involved in Indian organized crime.
Exactly.
Played by the director.
Director Jay Chandrasekhar.
Chandrasekhar, thank you. I didn't know how to say it.
And, you know, I was actually heartened for a second because when they first meet to discuss the heist, their black friend isn't with them. And I thought, oh, finally, okay, we're going to have a movie in which the black guy isn't turned to for the crime advice. But then they find Jay Chandrasekhar.
Somebody of color.
And you know, they just needed a brown guy with a funnier accent.
And a tracksuit.
Oh,
God. Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, and, you know, he's obviously a veteran of all these Broken Lizard movies. Kevin Heffernan, who I think is really funny in those movies. But, okay, here's another, like, nobody does that. There's a key plot point here that has to do with somebody sharing naked photographs of his girlfriend. Who has photographs anymore? He would totally have that on his phone.
He
whips these prints out. I'm like, what?
Did he get a CVS?
Yeah, did you get doubles? I mean,
exactly.
Oh, God. And that's just a minor point, but it's indicative of how, like, this movie is not taking place in anything resembling reality. And
no.
It's not funny. It's not funny, y'all. It's not funny. Is that the entire...
Really? Was there more to say about this movie?
No, just this week. I'm trying to think if we worked anything out.
We wanted to talk about Hope Springs.
Yes. So this wouldn't be an entire downer. Because it opens on Wednesday, I'm going to go ahead and jump the gun, and let's talk about Hope Springs, a movie that is being advertised to look awful. And it isn't.
It isn't.
You want to
give some of that? Lovely, actually. Yeah. It is Meryl Streep. Not doing a particularly defined accent, but still lovely. And Tommy Lee Jones as a long married 31-year couple who are now basically roommates.
Right.
And, you know, it's a situation you just don't see often enough on film. People who are mature, who aren't having sex, but still really want to.
Right.
And she decides that she's going to save this marriage at all costs, and she signs up. You know, she doesn't even have access to her own money. This kills me.
Right.
Doesn't have access to her own money, but goes and sort of behind his back, pays for this expensive week away in Maine with marriage therapy with Steve Carell,
right,
who plays their therapist. And it's sort of this intensive thing, and she sort of gives Tommy Lee Jones an ultimatum: you show up, or but I'm going to be there, and buddy, you better be on that plane.
Yeah, she's going to go to marriage therapy without him if he doesn't
exactly
show up.
And of course, he gets on the plane, and this is where the funny begins. And it's actually a really funny movie. Very baldly, boldly funny.
For one thing, Steve Carell is playing it totally straight.
I mean, to the point where he has no personality. He's so straight.
He's basically there just to listen to them and ask them questions and to be their sounding board. So, I mean, it's a really thankless but challenging, you know, they always say like 90% of acting is listening. And that's, listening is what he's there to do, pretty much. And this movie has really, I was stunned because it's directed by David Frankel, who did Devil Wears Prada, and somebody did that article on the internet a year or two ago, like, why doesn't Meryl Streep work with great directors? Did you see that one?
Yeah.
Where it's kind of like she's always doing like Nancy Myers and whoever that woman that did, you know, Mamma Mia and David Frankel, like these kind of people. So I wasn't expecting much from him, but I was amazed at how bold they were about letting the therapy sessions be long. Like, there are long sequences inside that therapy office, and it's just Meryl Streep and Tommy Lee Jones acting the hell out of it.
Going at it. I mean, and to be a little bit devil's advocate here, those long therapy sessions can seem a bit stagey. They can seem a bit claustrophobic. But both of those things sort of serve the acting.
Sure.
I mean, it just gives them a platform.
Because they're not comfortable to be there either.
No, which is perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a couple who is entirely uncomfortable with each other. They sleep in separate bedrooms.
Yeah.
You know, they don't touch anymore. They don't share anything anymore. So when they get assignments, homework, to do things like cuddle, you know, it takes them 20 minutes
to work out the mechanics. And I love the fact that this is a movie that takes the orgasms of a woman over 60 completely seriously.
Absolutely seriously.
There is no sniggering in this movie. There are no, like, Viagra jokes. You know, there's no, like, she doesn't, you know, the TSA doesn't take her vibrator in the airport. None of that kind of stuff that you think you're going to get in this kind of movie. It's really about these people and their feelings and what happened to this marriage and can they fix it? And
this is actually, I know it's strange to bring this up, but this is actually why I like this movie more than I did Magic Mike. Because Magic Mike does not take female sexuality seriously.
Interesting.
It completely robs women who are going to that movie of the experience of saying, these are really hot men and I'm going to get really into that. And this one does not do that. I mean, it's not about hot men, obviously.
Right.
But the notion that we have a sexuality that's real, that deserves to be respected, absolutely. 100% there in Hope Springs.
And you may not know this, but we've mentioned it on the show. I don't like Tommy Lee Jones, like, as a person. Like, I dealt with him once in real life, and it's I still bear the emotional scars. So for me to be able to put that aside and really get into him as an actor, he's so good in this, and she's so good
And he's such a surprise. I mean, this is not a man that you would pick for Arnold, not for this guy.
Yeah.
Especially when it forces him to really confront strong emotions. You know, and this is not a movie that's going to have everything fixed.
Right.
You know, but in a really pat way.
It plays to his strengths, though, because he is such a guarded and reserved person that you know, that gives the character somewhere to go, because he starts out with all the walls up and they have to start coming down if he wants to keep this marriage going.
Right. It's his character that has the developmental arc, not hers.
Sure, yeah. I mean, she's the motor of making things happen, but it's about him having to change as a person to think, although she does some too. I mean, they don't entirely let her off the hook as far as how they got to where they are, which is, I really admire this film. It's not perfect. There are some very on the nose song choices I could have lived without. but you know, given that I was expecting, like, at best a Lifetime movie and left with something that was maybe even more akin to, like, Scenes from a Marriage.
Right.
This is probably, like, my most pleasant surprise of the summer, I would say.
Well, I think that's a great recommendation. I mean, I really enjoyed it. I wouldn't say that it's one of my favorites of the summer, but it's certainly strong enough. Certainly the performances are strong enough to be noticed at Oscar time. I don't know that they will get a lot of attention, but they should be in the conversation.
Yeah, I hate the Oscars. They drive me up the wall. There are certainly performances that I hope get some notice by somebody, if not them, by critics groups or whoever, you know, like Rachel Weisz in Deep Blue Sea or whatever. But the Academy, that's such a not an arbiter of anything for me, you know, as far as if they like it or if they don't like it. It just, I don't know. I think it's sort of divorced from a reality of what matters, you know. For me, anyway. I mean, I know we wind up writing about it half the year, and I'm in the same boat, believe me. But I can't take it seriously anymore. So I will say they're great performances. Whether or not the Academy notices matters not one bit to me. And you know, I'm sure to them either. They've got one. You know, they've got a couple. She's got three. He's got one. You know, they're in good shape. I'm dying to know. What did you pick as your DVD?
Well, this one is a little controversial. Not everyone loved this, but it came out last month. Salmon Fishing in the Yemen.
Okay. I didn't see it. Dave was not a big fan, although he said it was the kind of movie he would take his mom to.
Exactly. And I think part of the reason it's the kind of movie you take your mom to is that it's the rare film in which everyone involved is actually trying to be their best. In terms of not just, you know, best performances, best version of themselves, beings that they know how to be. The gist of it is that Ewan McGregor is the United Kingdom's sort of greatest fisheries expert. So he's approached by Emily Blunt's character, who is, she's a consultant, basically, and she's been hired by a Yemeni sheikh to bring salmon fishing from the UK to Yemen, which, as you know, is kind of a bit of a desert. Mm-hmm. So this is a grand folly, the impossible dream. He has tons of money to make it happen, though. And, of course, Ewan McGregor's trying to block it in the beginning, but he eventually comes around to saying that maybe this could happen.
So this is the chick flick Fitzcarraldo.
If you must. But, you know, what's great about it is, again, everyone's trying to behave well. He's married. She's got a new boyfriend that's going great, except that the boyfriend's been posted to Iraq and is subsequently proved missing in action. Meanwhile, his marriage is kind of on rocky ground. And in the midst of it all, you've got Kristen Scott Thomas in the background as the Prime Minister's press secretary, and she is just wickedly funny, just stealing her scene. She's great. And you know, it's just one of those movies that you come out of it feeling so much better than when you walked in. It is almost therapy.
Okay.
I like it so much.
That sounds like the kind of thing I will put in TiVo for the next time I have the flu. If I can't find a Sandra Bullock movie,
It's perfect for the flu or the rare, rainy Los Angeles Sunday afternoon.
Oh, man. Both of them, right? Okay, good to know. My pick this week is a bunch of new Blu-rays come out this week, like of older films. Clue and Full Metal Jacket, right. And Disney's putting out like Romy and Michelle and High Fidelity and Gross Point Blank. And this made me feel old, the 25th anniversary edition of Adventures in Babysitting. Because I remember as a summer intern in college at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution interviewing Elizabeth Shue for that movie. But my actual pick this week is Bound, which is now on Blu-ray for the first time. A great movie. The first film from the Wachowskis. And certainly not, you know... It's not the kind of movie you look at and think, oh yes, these guys are going to make The Matrix. You know what I mean? It's a very straightforward non-genre. I mean, it's a genre film in that it's a noir thriller, but it's not like sci-fi in any way. And it's basically Jennifer Tilly is a gangster's moll living with Joe Pantoliano. But she has the hots for recently released ex-con Gina Gershon, who is working in her building fixing up an apartment, and gets Gina Gershon to join her in a scheme to steal a lot of money from Joe Pantoliano and get away with it. And so you don't know if they're going to get away with the crime. You don't know if they can trust each other. There's crazy hot lesbian sex that Susie Bright was called in to be the sort of consultant on. It's a great movie, really entertaining, really wonderful performances, and you know, now that Lana Wachowski has come out officially as a male to female transgendered individual, good for her. My pick this week is Bound. If you've never seen it, you will love it. It's a hoot.
And how are the salmon supposed to compete with hot lesbian sex?
Well, you know, we're trying to cover a broad range.
Thank you so much, Alonso.
Bound is not a movie to watch with your mom. So, you know, well, depending on who your mom is. But anyway, so I think, you know, we're trying to... A little bit of everything here on the knife. We're not going to do any letters this week. I'm going to wait for Dave to come back before we evaluate top 10 lists, including the Sight and Sound top 10 list. We will talk about that recent... The Sight and Sound magazine in the UK puts out a critics' top 10 and directors' top 10 list every decade, and the new one just came out this week, and we will discuss it next week and evaluate just how knife we think it is. And I finally remembered that it wasn't that I'd seen something where knife is used as an adjective. Did you ever watch The Adventures of Pete and Pete?
Yeah, of course.
Pipe was the word I was thinking of. Was something as pipe. They are doing a big Pete and Pete reunion this month at the Orpheum.
Interesting.
Yeah, part of the Everything Is festival that Cinefamily is doing. Dave and I have tickets. I'm very excited. It's going to be a Kreb kind of night. So, Alinda, where can people find you online?
Well, you can find me at people.com on the rare occasion that they do publish my reviews. I'm also at Movie Review Intelligence, and I tweet at Alinda Wheat.
Oh, A-L-Y-N-D-A-W-H-E-A-T, no underscore.
No underscore. Anything. Thanks for spelling it, because nobody would get that right.
Oh, honey, it's the story of my life. I've never not had to spell my name for people. So we want to thank you all for listening. I need to get my handy list of other podcasts that I like to plug. You can, of course, follow this show. You can like us at Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. You can check into us at GetGlue.com and drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes, and if you like us, please leave us a review. That would be super sweet and awesome. You can stream the show on Stitcher Radio or at TheLounge.com. And I want to point you towards... Sorry, I need a little more mimosa.
I drank all of mine.
Ms. Weed brought mimosas today. The ladies, you and Chrissy Lemire, love your bubbly water, your bubbly wine. Check out The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli. The Popcorn Mafia is ending, people. All the shows, it's crazy. Gray Drake, who was working with DavidMovies.com, just got a sweet new gig at RottenTomatoes.com. She's going to be their video editor and doing tons of interviews and such for the site. And she will also be participating on the Rotten Tomatoes radio show that airs on Sirius on Thursday afternoons. I want to say Channel 104. Anyway, but because she's now going to be on a Sirius radio show, she had to pull the plug on Popcorn Mafia. So she taped her very last episode yesterday, and that will be airing sometime in the next week. Cooking with Malcolm Ingram is now up at Film Threat, and you can subscribe at iTunes. Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Throwing Shade, Team Jack, The Schmoes Know, The B-Movies Podcast, Film Spotting SVU, Pod Crash with that Chris Gore, The Game Night Guys, and, of course, Secretly Timid. Alinda, thank you so much for coming.
This has been so much fun. I don't know why I was nervous.
I don't know either. We keep it casual.
Well, you know, the booze helped.
The booze always helps, but you also were effervescent.
So. You are too kind, sir.
Thank you for joining us, and thank you all for listening. We'll catch you next time. Bye.